A Thursday, November 9th edition of Connecticut Today, right here on WICC 600 AM 107.3 FM. We spoke with Adam Tyner from the Fordham Institute on how the nation's best local school systems are doing and how they get there with their ratings. And AUSA Chief Business Development Officer Leah Bailey and Quinnipiac Professor Patrice Luoma discussed the future of the recreational marijuana market for young entrepreneurs. We welcome Adam Tyner. He's an Associate Director for Research at the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, and they have released a new study, America's Best and Worst Metro Areas for School Quality. And of course, parents and loved ones and guardians always wanting to know where the best areas are, best schools and all that for all their kids. Adam Tyner, hi, it's Paul at WICC. How are you?
Doing great. How's it going, Paul?
Very well, Adam. Thanks. What went into to putting this report together? What kind of, Adam, what kind of numbers, metrics, guidelines did you folks at the Fordham Institute look at to put this whole thing together?
So what we did is we ranked the 100 largest metro areas in terms of their school quality. And the entire report, it's not just like a PDF report or something, it's actually an interactive website that we've created that your listeners can go to at metro.fordhaminstitute.org. You can go on the website, you can click around on the map, it's interactive. You can look at our rankings, but then you can also use the data that we've used to construct the rankings to create your own rankings. If you, you know, think that something should be weighted differently than we did it. It's very interactive and usable. So if users go to metro.fordhaminstitute.org, they can go and play around with the data themselves.
Cool. Now, number one here, and I always love looking at this stuff. I'm a numbers guy here. Before we get to some Connecticut numbers here, you found that Miami, the Miami Metro for schools, number one. Talk about that, the Miami area coming out on top.
So Miami, the Miami Metro includes most of South Florida. It includes Miami-Dade, Broward, and Palm Beach counties. And they come out number one among our largest metros in the country, the 50 largest metros in the country. We do a ranking of the 50 largest and then the 50 mid-sized metros. Miami's obviously in the 50 largest, and it was number one among those. I should say, you asked about the data, that we focus on student growth and student progress. Lots of education measures sometimes look at traditional ones. If you just kind of Google how are the schools in my area, you may find measures that are based mostly on kind of average academic achievement. But those of us at the Fordham Institute, I've long believed that what you have to do is look at student progress and student growth, because if you just look at the average level, it might seem like kind of a, you know, a kind of obscure distinction, but it's actually super important. If you just look at the level, you're going to find that some metros have students that are coming in way behind to begin with. And then you're kind of punishing the schools, even if they're making a lot of progress with those students. On the other hand, you might have places where people are already way ahead and students are already, you know, not facing a lot of the obstacles that students in other metros are, and then you're kind of rewarding the schools for that good outcome. So the way to isolate that is, and the effect that the schools are actually having, is to look at student growth, student progress. That comprises 80% of our rankings formula. And so Miami is making a lot of progress with the students that they have. We also control for demographics. But Miami Metro is doing really well at getting a lot of progress for the students that they have. Unfortunately, this is data that is restricted just to math and reading, because that is the kind of data that is comparable across the metros. Mm-hmm. But it's a limited look. That's not all education is. But we think it's a valuable signal to look at the progress that they're making in those core academic subjects. And then we've constructed those rankings around that.
Cool. Adam, hang on. We'll be right back with you. Adam Tyner, Associate Director for Research at the Thomas B. Fordham Institute. New ranking out on how some of the best metros are doing education-wise. We'll get to some Connecticut numbers coming back. Talk a little edumacation here. Adam Tyner, Associate Director of Research at the Thomas B. Fordham Institute. I'm going to put the link to this on the Facebook page when we get done a little bit later on. New report, America's Best and Worst Metros for school quality. They looked at the top 50 metros here mainly. Now, people are wondering about Connecticut. The metro that fits into the upper rankings is Hartford. And, Adam, this is kind of interesting because you have Hartford here at number 40 out of 50 in what you call the slam rank. But yet I see here Hartford is number 12 on what you call the raw achievement rank. Talk a little about that.
So, as I was saying a minute ago, a traditional way to look at school quality is just to consider the average level that the students are at. Mm-hmm. That's just raw academic achievement. That's a common way to think about it. And for some people, it may be the right way to think about it. We actually make all the data, including academic achievement data, available at metro.fordhaminstitute.org, where the interactive report can be found. But some places they have high achievement, but it's not clear, or the data suggests that the students are not making a lot of progress year to year. And so it's really not that the schools are performing well, but those students are already coming in doing pretty well because of family background or other things about them. And so when you really try to isolate the school impact, it looks really different. Hartford's one of those places.
Yeah, I see Boston here in New England is another one. You've got the Boston Metro. They are number one, top of the heap here out of 50 in the raw achievement rank. And I know Massachusetts, Adam, normally does well in these educational rankings, but you only have them at number 15 in the slam rank, which begs the question. Adam, do we have, and obviously you're into this more than I am, do we have acceptable national standardized numbers that allow researchers like you at Fordham and other places a really encompassing, complete look at this? Or is it hard, as you say, to judge from state to state or number to number? Do we have nationally accepted ways to look at this?
Well, education is extremely decentralized in the United States. So it's like 14,000 school districts, and they all have kind of their own thing going on to some extent. Since like the early 2000s, around 2002, 2003, there have been standardized tests for math and reading in grades 3 through 8 in every state, with a few exceptions of places where, something happened and they didn't do the testing or something. And of course, during COVID for the last couple of years, there's been very little testing. But for that period, up until COVID, we have a lot of testing data. And the data that we use is actually developed by researchers at Stanford University who took all of that testing data and they did some statistical wizardry to renorm it so that it would be comparable across state lines, which was really a fantastic new resource because we could actually compare metro areas and states and districts across the country instead of just being able to make those intrastate comparisons that were possible before. So the data that we're using are those data that were developed by those researchers at Stanford. That's the main data source that we're using. We do use some high school graduation data that comes from federal sources as well, but that's the main data source we're using, and that's what the rankings are based on.
So it seems to me then, Adam, it's almost like a baseball umpire where you're 50% right and 50% of the time to 50% of the people. So you have a scenario here where you have people that could say, well, see, what he just said proves we need more national standardized data. And then the other 50% would say, well, no, because what he just said here on the radio proves that you can standardize this stuff and you don't need the Bigfoot of federal education to come in and, Bigfoot all this.
Well, I think both are a little bit true because like you said, we are able to use this local data, but the only reason we're able to use the local data is because the National Assessment of Educational Progress, which is a national test, is conducted nationally. And so that federal data is actually how the researchers are able to come up with metrics where it would actually be comparable across state lines. So if there hadn't been that national test, we wouldn't have this data source.
A final question. I know this, Adam Tyner, may be a little bit of a loaded question, but people are always comparing American academic achievement, not just state by state or city by city, but country by country. And I've read oodles of stuff and saying, yeah, you know, we do okay, but man, we are still in a lot of ways far behind what China is doing, far behind what South Korea is doing, and places that graduate accelerated kids at higher levels. Are there lessons that we could take from those other countries, maybe, that we're not really implementing here?
There's a couple of things to think about. I actually spent some of my early career in China. I've been a teacher in China. I was a visiting scholar at Fudan University in Shanghai for a year. I wrote my doctoral dissertation about Chinese migrant workers within China. And I can tell you that those comparisons that they make educationally, most of it is based on an international assessment called the PISA. When they say that China is doing really well, what they're actually saying is that these few elite places in China where they actually test the PISA, that international test, that those places do well. But those places actually are not only like far and away the richest and most, you know, like they have the best level going in anyway, but they also like systematically exclude migrant workers. Those were the subject of my doctoral dissertation, but they systematically exclude them from taking those tests. So it's not really an apples to apples comparison at all. So I would just throw that out. That said, there's absolutely things that we can learn from, you know, looking at different systems around the world, at different practices around the world. And that's what educators and education policymakers should be doing to, you know, learn more about what other places are doing. But, you know, we've got 14,000 districts right here at home. We've got 100 metro areas that we've ranked on this new report at metro.fordhaminstitute.org. So we have a lot of lessons we can just learn here, but absolutely take an international perspective sometimes too.
Metro.fordhaminstitute.org. Adam Tyner has been the guest. Adam, thank you. We appreciate it. Fascinating stuff. I'll put the link up on our Facebook page. Take care. Happy holidays. And we'll chat down the road, I'm sure. Adam Tyner, thank you.
Have a good one, Paul.
Appreciate it. Adam Tyner there. Okay, folks, I'll put it up there. Metro.fordhaminstitute.org. You can check it out, see what's going on at the top metros, see how some of the Connecticut areas do there as well. And we continue right here on Connecticut Today, right here on WICC 600 AM, 107.3 FM, and online at WICC600.com. Paul Pacelli here, producer Eric on the other side of the glass. The fascinating discussion of the legalization of recreational use of marijuana here in the state. And now we are in the process of figuring out who can get into this business. What's it going to take? How much capital do you need? And then layer on to that the process that Connecticut has initiated with looking for so-called equity applicants makes it always a fascinating discussion. A couple of business leaders are taking part in a discussion sponsored by Quinnipiac University coming up tonight. It's called the Cannabis Industry Opportunities for Employment and Startups. It's a free webinar, free and open to the public. I'll give you the link in a few minutes. Participating in that, we have a couple of people. Leah Bailey, she's one of tonight's panelists. She's the Chief Business Development Officer for AUSA. Leah, hi. It's Paul at WICC. How are you?
Hi, I'm really good, Paul. Thank you so much for having me on.
Well, thank you for taking the time on a busy day. The other person who'll be participating tonight from the industry side is John Volkman, VP of Marketplace at Ease Technologies, which is a California cannabis delivery business. And it is sponsored by the People's United Center for Innovation and Entrepreneurship at Quinnipiac. And director of the center, Professor Patrice Luoma, is joining us as well. Professor, how are you?
I'm doing well. Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Well, thank you. Professor, first, we'll start with you. Why this webinar? Why do you think this is a timely topic?
So as director of the center, I'm trying to find opportunities for students and things that they're interested in. And this is obviously an industry that has gathered a lot of attention and momentum, and particularly now that Connecticut, New York, New Jersey all just legalized it. Most of New England has legalized recreational marijuana, except for one state. So I think it's something that students are interested in. They're interested in jobs in the industry. They're interested in what kind of majors they need to have or what kind of skills they need to have for various aspects of the industry. And also we have many students interested in startups, starting their own cannabis business. So it's a very popular topic.
Leah Bailey, as we mentioned, you're the chief business officer for AUSA. What are your thoughts on this, Leah? Again, thanks for joining us. And what does your firm, what is their involvement with this growing industry?
Sure. Let me start with that, and then maybe I'll go back to the other question. So our company is an offshoot of Aurora, which was the one of the largest companies in Canada, about $14 billion market cap at one point. This was their U.S. Their U.S. venture. They ended up dividing up because Aurora got on the New York Stock Exchange. So Australis, which is what AUSA is short for, is really a startup almost in the cannabis industry, which is really interesting to be a public startup because we are traded on the Canadian exchange and over the counter. But the CEO of Aurora and the founder of Aurora is our CEO. We had a dissident battle about a year ago because the company had kind of gone towards fintech. And now we are back being what I like to fondly refer to as a up-and-coming multi-state operator. We are based in Nevada. We have some business as well as in California. We've just gotten into Missouri. And my job as business development is looking at all the other states around the United States that we can grow in. So we are a very experienced management team, I believe, and we're looking forward to making some news in the cannabis industry nationwide. And I guess to answer the other part, so hopefully that answered a little bit about our company. Mm-hmm. But no, I think it's a fascinating field. I'm a consumer products manager for most of my life. I was CEO and president of different consumer products companies. And I think the ability that I had to get into cannabis about 4 years ago is really the most exciting thing I've ever done in my career. It's just so much fun to be in a brand new industry where things are starting from scratch and you can really make a difference. And I think the consumer side of it's really, really critical. So I'm a big fan of anybody who wants to join the industry.
And we continue right here on a Thursday edition of Connecticut Today. Paul Pacelli here, joined by a couple of guests. Leah Bailey, Chief Business Officer for AUSA, one of the panelists tonight in a free Quinnipiac University webinar, The Cannabis Industry, Opportunities for Employment and Startups, and also Professor Patrice Luoma, a professor of entrepreneurship and strategy at the Quinnipiac Business School. Professor, it's got to be interesting on your end to see students who want to get into this. And the back and forth must be fascinating is, you know, this is not, and believe me, we've all been there. I was in college at one time. This isn't growing weed in your dorm room. Okay. This is an industry here that, you know, was literally verboten like 10 years ago. And now all of a sudden it's just exploding. It's got to be interesting to hear, I would think, Professor, the questions and attitudes that some of your students have.
It is. Overall, the students are mostly positive and interested. They're interested in having startups, things like someone I just talked to yesterday, interested in being micro cultivator. Another one of our students is interested in having a bakery with CBD and THC products. And, you know, they aren't necessarily well-versed in what it takes to be part of this industry. So I think our panelists will help to shed some light on how you can get into this industry, what skills you need, what connections you need, what are some of navigating the legal and other kinds of requirements.
Now, Leah Bailey, from your business end at AUSA, I mean, obviously, I would think, correct me if I'm wrong, but there's got to be a certain amount of capital available to some of these people, if not all of them, who are serious about getting into this business, correct?
Well, there's some state by state. I would say capital is one of the most difficult parts of the business because you cannot get a standard bank loan because of the fact that it's federally illegal. So the only time that you'll get involvement from any sort of a bank would be a state bank or a credit union. Some of the states, though, when they do the social equity plans, they actually will give some state money out, but it's very limited. So I would say capital is probably the biggest hurdle in this industry.
And that fascinates me. Do you see, Leah, a point, and I know it's been discussed in D.C., like, hey, it's time we end the federal moratorium on marijuana being legalized by the states, A, because the industry is here, and B, there is also a research aspect of this in hospitals and universities. But is there any buzz in your industry that Congress or the House or the Senate may say, all right, it's here, we need to allow the big banks, the big credit firms, the big houses, brokerage houses to get involved in this?
I think the first thing that will happen, there's several different things that are in front of the Congress. The federal legalization, I think, is not going to happen in the near future. So that would be obviously the most sweeping legislation where you could ship across state lines. But the SAFE, which is the Banking Act, I think has a better shot. I know it's got bipartisan support. It would make a huge difference because right now people are doing a lot of transactions in cash, and that's just not real safe. If you go to a dispensary, they will take debit cards, but you can almost never use a credit card because the credit card companies, you know, are affiliated with the banks and can't support it. So I really, really hope it'll also allow NASDAQ listing, which you can't do right now if you're a U.S. cannabis company. So I hope in the next couple of years we'll see the banking pass. That would make a big difference, and I think that would help funds being more available for people who wanted to do startups. Right now you're dealing with friends and family kind of money is really the best way to get it.
And Patrice Luoma, it must be fascinating to hear your students and to talk to them about something that they see as a burgeoning industry, yet I wonder if they have the conception that this is still regulated at a federal level and there are still some states that, for whatever reason, cultural, political, some areas of the country still want nothing to do with this, even though they know it's being used by people.
That's correct. And so I think having this webinar will be very helpful to our students to kind of inform them as to some of the overarching rules and regulations in the industry. I have myself looked through the portals in Connecticut, New York, New Jersey, and they all have a lot of for students to look at on some of the rules and the procedures for getting started. And then there's also that question of, well, can we do this on campus? I said, no, I'm sure you can't because alcohol is all on campus. So, no, you will not be able to do this on campus. But, yeah, there's a lot of interest and anything that we can do to help the students kind of move forward in their industry of choice is very helpful to them.
Finally, Leah Bailey, again, Chief Business Officer of AUSA, who will be involved in the webinar tonight. I'll have the web address for you momentarily on that. What do you tell people, or what would you tell people, Leah, who are saying, you know, well, geez, this is kind of interesting. I may want to do this. It's new. I want to get in on the bottom rung here and work my way up. I'm young. I want to do this. I'm really driven to do this. What would you tell them?
I tell them it's a fabulous industry. Again, I feel really fortunate that I found it. I think legalized cannabis is so important because of the testing that goes behind it so that the people who do buy the product know that they're getting a safe product, which is why I think legalization is absolutely critical so that you know the products that are on the market don't have mold and mildew and all the things that we have to test for. So I'm a big fan of the industry. And I think for a young person, it's a lot of opportunity. I think they have to realize that it's not as easy as that. You're right. It's not like growing a weed. The cultivation side of it is unbelievably technically complicated. And I think, you know, as we move closer to GMP, good manufacturing practices being involved, you really want to go somewhere and learn how to do it at scale. So while the smaller grows make some sense, it's a pretty tough industry to go ahead with without having capital behind you. Dispensaries are a little bit easier, but then there's all sorts of federal legalization, federal rules regarding taxation that make them not so profitable. So I would say absolutely look into it, get into it, but make sure you go with people who can teach you the industry before you just jump in.
Leah Bailey, Chief Business Officer for AUSA, and Professor Patrice Luoma, Professor of Entrepreneurship and Strategy at the Quinnipiac Business School.